Oh, waiter. Yes, I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Rochelle Aldebay, who is doing a combined Bachelor of Science Honours, I'm presuming the H's, and a biomedical and a Master of Science in Biomedical and Molecular Sciences under the supervision of Dr. Myron Suchek. Welcome to Grad Chat, Rochelle.
How are you?
I am good. So what is this combined undergrad-grad program that you're doing? How does that work?
So basically, I graduated from my undergrad, so now I'm in my first years of my master, but in my undergrad, I was doing a thesis project, and so that work I was able to take and combine it into my master's, so it would afford me less time for my master's.
So you did some grad programs, as courses as well?
Yes, I did.
In that fourth year?
Yeah, in the fourth year.
Which is brilliant. I mean, yeah. I know there's a few programs that are doing that now to help you reduce the time in doing a master's. And it also sort of helps you, I think, understand what is research all about before you make that big jump.
I agree, 100%. I feel if I didn't have that opportunity in my undergrad, I would be completely lost now. Not to say I'm not, but there's always room for improvement.
Well, you haven't chosen a particularly easy topic or easy field of study. Now, you are only in your first year, of course.
Yes.
Even though that you've done some coursework in your undergrad, as you mentioned. But you're working on the impact of cannabis on cancer metastasis mediated through epigenetic rewiring. Okay, yes. Well, before we even get an overview of that, can you explain some of these words? Metastasis, epigenetic rewiring, what do those words mean? Just to make sure we all understand where we're going.
Of course. Before I start, I just want to give a really big thank you to my supervisor, Dr. Suchek, and David Bunsek. He was the graduate student who did most of this research.
Ah, right.
Yeah, and so now I'm kind of continuing on his project. But so to start off, cannabinoids are cannabis, and you have endocannabinoid system, which is kind of your natural cannabinoid system. Besides, you know, what we already know of, like the cannabinoids that you would inhale or ingest.
Okay.
Your body has a natural endocannabinoid system.
Oh, does it?
Yes,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I thought people just smoked weed and that was it.
Yeah. So, you know, when you do smoke, like the cannabinoid particles, they act on they act kind of as agonists to your endocannabinoid receptors. And so the endocannabinoid system is actually super interesting. It's involved in a lot of different developmental processes. And even during fetal progression, it's very, very vital. And there's a lot of research online that shows that, you know, in some cases where there are defects in the endocannabinoid system, there could be a halt in development. So that's super interesting. But to move on to the second term, cancer metastasis is simply just the spread and progression of cancer. So it's when you have cancer and it unfortunately spreads into other sites of the body.
Right.
And then epigenetic rewiring. Epigenetics in themselves are just kind of a mechanism of gene regulation. So how your body regulates what to express, right? So each cell has the same DNA, but each cell has different functions, and those are regulated through epigenetics. So in sum, when I'm saying rewiring, I'm saying that we're trying to see if cannabinoids can cause cancer metastasis or the spread of cancer by rewiring your epigenetics or the expression of your genes to essentially enhance a metastatic phenotype of the cells or to cause the cancer cells to be more metastatic, which is
more,
again...
More active, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
more
exactly.
Active. And you don't want that. You want the opposite. You want
exactly.
it to be suppressed.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, like, of course, a lot of nitty-gritty biological details when I'm saying metastatic phenotypes, but for now, yeah, like, that's the simple explanation to it.
And that was just the heading.
Yeah.
And look at what we found out already. So what is the actual purpose of the use of cannabinoids to assist with cancer treatment?
So most of the times, they aren't given as treatment, but they're given as adjunct to chemotherapy. So when patients feel nauseous or if they have pain, a lot of the times they are given cannabinoids. But what we were doing is there's no research up to date that kind of explores the impact of giving cancer patients cannabinoids or, you know, cannabis as part of a treatment. And we were wondering, there is literature about its genomic effects or essentially mutation to the specific DNA.
Right.
But we don't know if it can in any way cause epigenetic rewiring. And so we wanted to see, is it good or is it, you know, going to be harmful to give cancer patients cannabinoids alongside the chemotherapy?
So a lot of people think that, you know, using cannabinoids is, regardless what else it does, it's if it gives you that comfort, surely it's good to be able to have. Because a lot of people have a lot of pain and they find using cannabinoids can help reduce that pain.
Yeah. So,
but you're saying it's more than that.
Yes. So, and I understand that perspective, right? But this is why we do research. So within our research, we were able to, and I'll get into more detail later on, but we're able to figure out that, you know, different cannabinoids or synthetic cannabinoids can still give you the therapeutic effect of cannabis while ensuring that it doesn't, you know, aggravate cancer metastasis or cause any sort of epigenetic rewiring.
Right.
So yeah, and I'll get more into that later, but there's still research that needs to be done so that we ensure that, you know, patients can still get the therapeutic side of cannabis while they are being, you know, safe. And yeah.
Okay. Well, which is great. So let's go into a bit more into your research.
Okay.
So can you give us a bit of an overview of what you are specifically trying to do? And I know it is low level or small level, but can you make it a little bit bigger for us?
Yes, of course. This is the hard part, but here we go.
This is the hard part, but I know you can do it.
Yeah, I'm going to try my best. I'll start off with the very, very top of it, right? We're talking about cannabinoids and cannabis. So within your system, cannabinoids can work on a lot of different receptors, but the main two types are cannabinoid type 1 receptors and cannabinoid type 2 receptors. The type 1 are predominantly found in your central nervous system, and the type 2 are found in your peripheral nervous system. And so within the undergraduate project, the one that David Buncik was completed, he focused on the cannabinoid type 1 and to kind of see the...
So that was the nervous system one.
The central nervous system, yes. And he just wanted to see kind of the different effects that different CB1 cannabinoids can have on your body. And for me, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that into account and expand on it and look at the cannabinoid type 2. Yeah. And so the important part about this research and really kind of the main point or the main molecular point is trying to understand the mechanism, right, of how they could cause, you know, cancer metastasis. Because we do have research that shows that they do increase the metastatic phenotypes.
Okay. But so you've already got that information.
Yes, we have that information. Right. And we kind of have looked at, you know, the difference. And when I say metastatic phenotypes, I'm really referring to epithelial mesenchymal transition, which is the sort of molecular process that cells undergo to become more kind of like their progeny cells. Like they kind of de-differentiate to go back into more mobile cells so that they can travel throughout the body and then kind of...
Right, which yeah, we don't want.
We don't want,
exactly. We want to stop that.
We want to stop that, yes.
So these receptors are really important because they're the ones that are saying, yes, go for it, or yes, no, don't.
Exactly, yeah.
All right.
That's perfect. You explained it better than I could. And so, yeah, and to kind of complement that, we're looking at, or the cannabinoid receptors are G-protein coupled receptors.
So what is a G-protein receptor?
Okay, that's an awesome question.
Because there's all these extra names.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole different, you know, group of receptors within your body. G-protein coupled receptors are a family of receptors.
Right.
The cannabinoid type 1 and cannabinoid type 2 are a type of G-protein coupled receptors because there's just so many different types, right?
And they all have different functions, I'm assuming.
Exactly, yeah. So it depends on like the molecule or the ligand that binds to the receptor. It has to be specific.
What's a ligand?
A ligand is, just think of it as like a chemical messenger or the molecule. Like cannabinoids, for example, when we work in the lab, we use, you know, solutions of, let's say, a CB1 agonist, which is just kind of a chemical ligand that is binds and works like the natural ligand would work on the receptor.
Okay.
I hope that was...
Yes, yeah. No, that's all good. Okay. See, we're getting there, aren't we? So maybe we have to sort of rethink when someone says, which is so natural to you,
yeah,
just talk about these things, and then someone else goes, oh, hang on a minute, what does that mean? And then we have to think a little bit about, okay, let me see this. What's the equivalent to that,
yeah,
in easier terms?
Or how I can explain it in a way where it kind of like simplifies clarifies the meaning of it.
Which because the main thing is not overcomplicating,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is not an easy thing to do when you're working, as we mentioned before, when you're working at the micro level.
Yeah,
because
agree.
It all makes total sense to you. This is why, I mean, you mentioned before you even started, you know, pity we can't have visuals on the radio.
Yeah, that would
because
help
be so
much.
Because it would be so much easier to explain how the connections work along the way.
I agree, because like seeing a visual of, you know, what we like hypothesize the receptor mechanism is, would help because I could just kind of like, you know, like follow along. To
mind you, the one that you sent me was pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. It looks very complex, but honestly, it's super simple. I mean, it probably is a lot more complex within your body, but just explaining it could be simple if there was a visual.
If there was a visual.
Yeah.
But you know what? We don't have that luxury, so we're going to have to keep on going.
Yeah.
So what else are you doing? Because I did interrupt you, I'm afraid, when I asked you these, you know, what these words meant.
So, yeah, so going kind of back to the G-protein coupled receptors, which, as I mentioned, the cannabinoid type 1 and type 2, which I'm going to refer to as CB1 and CB2,
okay,
respectively, they are a type of G-protein coupled receptors. And recently, literature has kind of found that these G-protein coupled receptors can have a biased agonism to them or functional selectivity. And so what I mean by that, mm-hmm, is... think about it like this. The cannabinoid receptors, right, they can bind to multiple different... I'll focus on CB1 for now. They can bind to multiple different CB1 ligands or chemicals. And what research has shown is that depending on the chemical that binds to that receptor, it can cause sort of this differential response that results in a different cellular response as a whole.
Okay.
Right? And yep. So when we're doing our research with these different CB1 and CB2 cannabinoids, we kind of look to see, okay, so one has increased this metastatic marker and the other one not so much, but wait, that has increased, you know, colocalization or some sort of
chemical reaction,
yeah,
along the way.
Yeah, so it causes sort of like a different... cellular response, and
it's
super interesting because then that way, you know, you've got to do a whole lot of more research to really understand and see which cannabinoids would specifically, you know, cause cancer metastasis or which would, you know, inhibit it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of goes back to the whole question that you asked earlier about, you know, using cannabinoids still or cannabis still for, you know, relief or for therapeutic means. And, you know, more research is needed to figure out specifically which cannabinoid can bind and induce that cellular response that we want and that is good.
Because that's the problem. I mean, you see all these drugs that get advertised,
yes,
on the telly,
yeah,
and 45 seconds out of the minute is talking about all the things that could happen,
yes,
to you,
yeah,
as opposed to, well, we told you to take this because it helps in this one area. But... it could also have a side effects of this, this, and this. And I'm thinking, yeah. Oh my goodness.
I mean, I know.
And we're still putting it out there, but we could have all these side effects. And I know something can't be necessarily good for everybody, because as you said, everyone is different.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what you're doing here.
Yeah.
I mean, the ultimate aim for you, if I'm understanding correctly, is finding out how you can stop cancer progression by the use of cannabinoids.
Yes.
And maybe, luckily, if we can get it to the calming and less pain part of it, without causing other issues down the track or down the line of, you know, what is happening.
Yeah.
So that's the nuts and bolts of it. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly that. And then just a very quick addition to that, making sure understanding that, you know, the cannabinoids that are currently used in treatment aren't, you know, aggravating the cancer that the patients already have, because there is a very, very large gap in knowledge on cannabinoids, because recently in contemporary times, they have like just increased in use in recreational and clinical, but our awareness hasn't lined up to that.
Right.
So a lot more research is needed.
But then I guess the other thing is, as we know with the word cancer, I mean, not all cancers are the same, so they don't all behave the same way. So the one that, you know, the experiments that you're doing, is it in relation to a very specific cancer, or is it hoping that it can be modeled for all cancers?
That's a fantastic question, because, yeah, I agree. A lot of the times people think, oh, like, why isn't there a cure for cancer? But what they don't understand is there's such a large heterogeneity in cancer and different cancer types, and even within the same patient. Like, if a patient does have metastasis, the different tumors can have very, very different properties, right? And so what we're doing is we're kind of like starting off, you know, within a couple of cancer lines. We have done the pancreatic cancer lines and colorectal cancer lines.
I know that one.
Yeah, I can't.
Colorectal. Yep.
Thank you. And so that's what we're focusing on right now. But actually that's what we focused on with the CB1.
Right.
But for my project, I kind of wanted to expand on that. And I wanted to also look at breast cancer, but I wanted to also look at chemo-resistant pancreatic and triple negative, like, so chemo-resistant breast cancer cells. So just to see if, like, you know, within pancreatic cancer cells by itself that aren't chemo-resistant, what effect does it have? And then if it is chemo-resistant, is that going to be even a greater aggravation? Because, you know, if you take just pancreatic cells by themselves and then the chemo-resistant pancreatic cells, you know, what can we expect to see?
What can you expect?
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point there, in terms of you're looking specifically at cannabinoids.
Yes.
But if a patient is also going to be having chemo or radiation and things like that, you know, so cannabinoids by itself may do this much to help.
Yeah.
But does it still do that much to help if someone's already had chemo and things, or the other way around?
Yeah.
You know, if they've had chemo, does actually having cannabinoids actually make it worse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, especially when it comes to understanding the body, it's just, again, I can't stress this enough, it's so complex. Like you were saying, there's so many side effects that happen. And that's because, you know, one drug that is made is intended to act on exactly, you know, the molecular component that it's supposed to act on. But it can also act on so many different
other
ones
things
that we don't want to. But, you know, they release it because they know that it's going to cause a greater benefit than harm. So, yeah, it's definitely very complex.
Does it? Okay, I'm probably going too far ahead. You may not be able to answer this. Cannabinoids in general. I mean, yes, people have taken them in the past to help ease pain and things. We've seen results of that. And if there aren't proper results, the people themselves think it's working for them. Great. If it helps someone reduce pain, that's great. Do you think it's going to come to a time where they go, well, we should all be having this because you found out a thing that's going to stop this receptor? Now, I know you're talking about metastasis cancer, or cancer that's already, well, cancer's already there. What happens if the cancer isn't there yet? Would this product, cannabis, help stop it coming in the first place?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's another step, right?
Exactly. It's another step and another, you know, level or, you know, field that we have to also look into. But, like, so far, my research has kind of found out that, you know, cannabinoids do in fact cause cancer metastasis. So we're saying that they're not good.
Right,
they're
like, right. I forgot about that part. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's cancer cells there, but it's helping it spread.
Yes, exactly. Because right. What we do basically is when we have different experiments, and I'm not going to, again, get into the details mm-hmm. of it. But we have different experiments, and we kind of, first of all, look to see, okay, so do these cannabinoids cause, you know, an increase in these different metastatic markers? And then if so, we want to better understand how they would do that. And we have looked at this molecular mechanism, which is the G protein-coupled receptor that I was telling you about, and its functional selectivity. And specifically, this is a very, very long name, but so the receptor that, or the mechanism that we have, you know, found the cannabinoid receptors to work with is called the GPCR Nu1 MMP9 signaling paradigm.
And she did that without even reading it.
And yeah, it's not as complex as the name sounds, but I mean, if you saw a picture, you might think it was complex, yeah. But yeah, it's a whole bunch of different cellular components that come together to essentially activate what is known as your nuclear factor kappa B. And this is implicated in transcription regulation. And so we're saying that, you know, through this mechanism, the cannabinoids can then activate this NF-kappa-B to lead to an increase in these metastatic phenotypes through rewiring your epigenetics.
Wouldn't the easiest thing to be is just not have cannabinoids if you've already got cancer?
Yeah.
From what you've just told me? I mean, because if they help spread and you don't know how to a point, or how to stop it,
yeah,
then why give it in the first place?
So here's the thing.
Other than for peace of mind and calmness.
That's a fantastic question, because you are right. Like, if you look at the preliminary research or the results, you would say, oh, okay, so cannabis isn't good. So maybe we shouldn't, you know, give cannabis to cancer patients or for, you know, as a chemotherapy adjunct. But in reality, this research actually has a very significant clinical impact, because what we can do is, when we understand the different impact and molecular mechanism of these cannabinoids, we can then understand how we can modify it, or how we can, especially with, you know, the technology that we have nowadays, and there's so many synthetic cannabinoids that are always, you know,
yep,
being made, we can modify it or even bring in another sort of a chemical compound. I will actually speak about something in 1 second. Let me just finish this thought. Bring in another chemical compound to kind of alter it while still having, you know, those therapeutic effects of cannabinoids. So
right.
The simple answer is, I guess, yes, with the results, it would be easier. But of course, in research, I'm going to say this one more time, the complex answer is we need to better understand so that we can actually formulate a better clinical approach and a clinical treatment to patients with, you know, cancer.
That was very well said.
Thank you. And so, actually, to go back to the point I just wanted to mention, in the lab, we're also, over the summer, we've looked at different natural compounds and their role in this GPCR network that I was talking about. And so we looked at epinephrine, we looked at nicotine, we looked at caffeine, and another graduate student currently is looking at estrogen. And so the cool thing about this is we found that epinephrine and caffeine actually have anti-metastatic effects.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So obviously a lot more research is needed, because this is still very much in the preliminary
steps. Drinking my coffee every day
is
working for me.
Yeah, but no sugar, because we do have research that also shows that natural and artificial sweeteners can cause cancer.
Don't worry, I don't have sugar.
That's fantastic.
So good.
So yeah, with this GPCR that my professor is working with and the lab works with, it has a lot of different implications, because, again, GPCR is a family, right? It's like mm-hmm. a category of receptors, and different ligands will bind to their specific receptors. Like, cannabinoids bind to their receptors. The epinephrine will bind to its receptor. But the major, you know, point of this is that we have found these cannabinoid or GPCR receptors, to heterodimerize, or in other words, I'll say interact,
right,
with this other receptor called NMBR. You can look that up if you'd like. This is going to be really hard to explain. But yeah, and it causes this, you know, whole downstream cellular signaling that will then lead to the effects, right? And so we've explored different GPCRs and different ligands, like epinephrine, cannabinoid, sweeteners, caffeine, and we've saw, you know, different effects.
Varying effects.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. Sorry, excuse me. One thing that I always find interesting when we look at our human body, we should be putting natural products into our body, right? And you use the word several times, synthetic, mm-hmm. which to me means being made in the lab. Is that actually good? Or because you haven't got some other things in there that perhaps we shouldn't have? Or should we always be looking at the natural?
These are great questions. So the first thing that comes to my mind right away is, I'm just going to speak like in general term mm-hmm. to all the drugs and compounds that we do take. A very large majority of drugs are synthetic, but they are derivatives of plants and natural components or compounds that are found, you know, in nature. And so what they do is like they kind of alter it so that it, you know, specifically targets what we want to treat. So they kind of like tweak it so that it's more directed towards, you know, treating that specific illness.
So playing with the genetics.
Yeah, exactly. And so synthetics, like, this is a very debated topic, right? And I feel like we can go hours about this, talking about the good and the bad of using synthetics. I feel like as long as there is proper research done, and when I say proper, I really mean long-term as well.
Yep.
Because especially now with the increase and rise in, you know, the different drugs, the different accessibility to compounds that we don't really understand, it can have a long-term impact, not on us, but maybe on the next generation. Mm-hmm. And that we won't know, right? And at that point, maybe we kind of have, for a lack of a better word, screwed it for them, you know? And so it's a very, you know, complex topic.
Well, that's the thing with research, right? You can't just put something on the market because it worked once.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. It has to be long-term. And even some of those long-term studies, you still may not get it right because it may not show up in 10 years as being bad. It may show up in 50 years' time.
Exactly.
So you do have to be careful, which is great that you are being careful to help us, which is why I'm sure they put all those extra, well, you could have these side effects.
Yeah. And you also have to kind of think about the benefits of it, right? Because these drugs, although they're synthetic, a lot of the times they do really increase the quality of life of the patient, or they do really treat the illness or the ailment. And with that, again, you know, they might treat the illness, but is it going to, and I'm going to bring epigenetic rewiring into this, because everything can rewire your epigenetics. Is it going to rewire your epigenetics so that it, you know, can harm future generations, or maybe it's not going to have an effect and it's just helping you and that's it.
Which is great.
Yeah.
A lot to do in a short time for you, but I'm sure whatever you're working on, then the next person can take over that project and take it to the next step, which I would imagine as a researcher, you'd be thinking, well, can you keep me informed of what goes next? Because I was really sure that this was going to work. And if you didn't find it work, then why? Because I'd like to know why.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
and even I feel like if I have the opportunity to take this experiment with me on to, because I plan to graduate this year, but if I have this opportunity to take it on and, you know, expand on it, then I definitely will. Because, you know, seeing it kind of start from the ground and growing just to better understand.
Well, I think that sums you up totally, actually, because I was looking at some of your extracurriculars. I mean, when you take something on, you take something on and you want to see it through. Like, you know, St. Mary's Drop-In Centre student volunteer, Riviera Community Living recreational volunteer, UNICEF Queens graphic coordinator, Queens Cardiac Research Committee, financial director.
Yeah.
I mean, you've taken on a lot of things here. None of them would be easy to do.
Yeah.
But you're clearly passionate about them and want to help.
Yeah, I definitely do. Like, because that's the thing, right? Like, you are a product of this world. And I believe that, you know, with my time here, I want to do something with it. And I want to, as much as I can, get involved with the community and just do anything
Make a difference.
Yeah, make a difference.
You want to make a difference. Yeah. And I think that's very admirable. And I know you're going to make a difference in everything
that
you do. I
really hope so. Thank you.
You will. So good luck with it all.
Thank you.
Good luck with your application for med school.
Thank you.
I'm sure that'll go well too for you.
If you're listening, med schools, please let me in. I'll be a fantastic physician.
She's a good one. She's a keeper. Yes. So, Rachel, it has been great chatting with you. Thanks for coming on the show. And like I said, good luck with everything. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. And don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
On Saturday, November 30th, the Independent Wrestling Academy, in cooperation with CFRC 101.9 FM, presents IWA Wrestling School of Rock. A portion of the proceeds from this family-friendly professional wrestling event will be donated directly to CFRC's annual funding drive. Tickets are available for $20 and can be bought through iwacanada.ca. The event is scheduled to take place at the Upper Hall of the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. Doors at 5 p.m., opening bell will be at 5:30. Be sure to check out cfrc.ca and iwacanada.ca for additional event details. We hope to see you there, and we hope you're ready to rock the Spire.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Sego.
Buju Anin.
Danach A. Ak Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tanse.
Ay, Inuhadikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Welcome to Words and Culture. But I also have many nicknames. I'm also known as Mara, Maji, Mala, and I am Cham to my guest today. I'm your host in these episodes about Inuktitut, the language of us Inuit. There's something that we Inuit share that make us feel more connected, and it's nicknames. Do you have nicknames too? If you look at the map of the North, you'll see that there are no roads that connect us, so we still use the power of radio and television to share our information because the North has very poor internet connection. Chamanai or Lucy Kavavaukanai met in high school. You see, Lucy and I and others in the High Arctic also went to residential school. In our case, we were experiments to see how well we could survive in leaving our families in our small towns to attend high school in an Inuit community that provided grades 9 to 12. In high school, we had a very strict English teacher named Adele Corey. Cham and I were in Adele's communications class and volunteered our weekends hosting the local radio show in Mitimatalik, or in Pond Inlet in English, where we were sent for school. Lucy Kavavauk and I called each other Cham because we had no one else but each other. Our families were so far away from us. Lucy is now the co-CEO of Inuit TV. That's a channel that is available to Inuit around the world, no matter where they are, for all material that's mostly in Inuktitut. Here's my conversation with my chum, one of my bestest friends, Lucy Kavavauk. Her family too was relocated by the federal government, even before my family was. I just want to start with the most recent news of you, so that our audience gets a picture of where we come from as Inuit, specifically you and your family. Arctic Bay was a place where your parents were sent. Your parents are Unalingu Inuktitut speaking elders. But you've been fighting for something very special for them. Can we start there and talk about the relocation of your family?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Thank you for the introduction. So there's a former MLA, he's the oldest MLA in Nunavut to date, Isaac Suyuk. I'll just refer to him as Suyuk from this point. He's one of the last remaining direct descendants from a relocation that happened in 1935. It's actually first recorded in the federal government. So 1935, from Kingite, formerly called Cape Dorset, there was my grandfather, and it was his mother and her children that were moved from Kingite to Tallorotete, which is called Dundas Harbour in English. They were told that it was going to be a two-year thing where they were brought up through the Nascope boat, Hudson Bay telling them that they were the best fox trappers, and that they wanted them up there for 2 years to get fox fur, and then they were going to send them back down to Kingite in 2 years' time. So that's how it all initially started, and they had a very rough start. But 2 years later, Nascope came, as they suspected, to go back to Kingite. Instead, they came with building supplies and dropped them off to Arctic Bay. In total, there were five relocations, from Tallorotete to Fort Ross, two Fort Rosses, a couple of other places, and ultimately ended up in Taloyoak. Suyuk really wanted an apology from the federal government. He felt left out, why other relocations have gone through and this one has not been recognized. My cousin Sarah Phillip and I started putting on the paperwork, taking care of the paperwork. We got a lawyer about 10 years ago, excellent lawyer, and he has dealt with relocations like this, the most recent one being Ahermut in Arvet area. He was already familiar with relocations. And so in December, we had our first Zoom meeting with the federal government after 12 years. We do have a society. We do have a board. Suyuk is one of our elder advisors. And we had our first face-to-face meeting with the federal government, Suyuk being the lead, Sarah, myself, our lawyer, and his assistant.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible, because for our listeners who may not know, my family was also relocated by the federal government in the 1950s from northern Quebec all the way to the high Arctic. So your relocation of your family happened before, but the legal process is just moving forward with the help of Elder Suyuk, who I remember as a member of legislature for Nunavut, and he was unilingual Inuktitut speaking. All his member statements were in Inuktitut. And this is how far we've come as Inuit, by the resiliency of people like Suyuk. You agree?
Completely, completely. There must have been about five or six federal government representatives and the people that I have had mentioned. And right before the meeting started, Suyuk said, "Can I go change now?" And he came back with a red anorak, silapak, Inuit-made garment that we use. I suppose that's how we would say it. And he came back and it was red. And straight off the bat, he said, "I am here wearing this red as it's symbolizing our ancestors that have gone through huge amount of pain for what the federal government did to us. And this represents hardship. And I'm here carrying that. And I want you to see how this has affected our lives. But at the end of these meetings, at the end of these negotiations," and he pulled out a white one, and he said, "I'm hoping to wear this to represent everyone's gone through healing. This is something that has been purified, that we no longer carry that pain, and we're hoping to work together with you.
Yeah, our elders, and I think that we've been very fortunate to have been brought up by Unilingual Inuktitut speaking elders. As a mother, when I read and when people read of your experiences and former employment online, because everybody Googles everyone, and when they Google you, they'll find that you have three amazing children. And I just want to make that connection from the relocation to, and this happened years ago, to you helping fight for your father and his family, your grandparents. How important is this for you to allow your children see that this is part of our history, that they may not clearly know yet, but nor do our listeners. So the importance of having people understand what relocations have done to Inuit all across Inuit country.
Definitely. I hadn't realized, because we do things without really, in this case, like, not really talking to anybody about this, just paperwork, and just, it just took a lot of years to get to this point. And when we were going for our meetings last month, I was talking to one of my children, and I was like, you know, the relocation file. And he was like, what are you talking about? You've never shared that with me. And I was like, oh, all these years they grew up, and I didn't share that information with him, and I was shocked. And I was telling them about it, and they were just completely in awe. It is because of the work. And I did tell them it is because of our elder. And he emphasizes that it really needs to be before he passes. He's in his 80s now. This is time sensitive, because we were hoping the elders that were alive would be there to actually see an apology. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's about.
That is so true. I remember whenever I came home at Christmas or summer from going to school with you, like, we would leave home for, like, we'd get to go home at Christmas, and we'd get to go home in the summer for a couple months. And I remember my grandmother did not talk to me or tell us about their own relocation. And it wasn't until the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples came out with a report that did I learn about what happened to my family, what happened to my grandparents. And it's really heartbreaking. So if our listeners want to look up, there are some, how do you call them, injustices by our country that so many people don't know about, let alone our own families. Like, there's still a lot of reading to do and storytelling to do, which makes it important, I guess, for you to use your capacity also as co-CEO of Inuit TV to be able to share those stories of the older people, of our elders from our communities, that show what huge changes they went through. And this is not 100 years ago, everyone. It's like, we're recent. We're not even 50 yet, and we have this experience. I wanted to talk to you also about Inuit TV and your role in this. Is it's new, and it was huge news, and I wanted to ask how you're doing in that role.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy you brought up Inuit TV. It's one of my favorite things of all time to talk about. So about 17 years ago, there were Inuit that gathered together. There were educators, elders, youth, filmmakers, language keepers, and it became clear that we need to be hearing our language more. We need to be seeing our culture more. At the time, and it was all you, when you turn on the TV, it's all in English, nothing in our language. It was great when APTN came along. We were very, very excited. But APTN also has all of the indigenous languages, cultures that they have to cover in Canada, and there's many. So the amount of Inuktitut or our culture that we were watching was clearly not enough. And so that's where that idea came in. There's been a few things that have been done in the background to get to this point, but the dedication of our board members, their expertise, current and over the years, have really brought us where we are. So NTI gave us seed money of 2.3 million for a 3 year for us to be able to start up. And that's where Tom and I came in. We were the first InuTV employees, both as co-CEOs. Tom McLeod, who is based out of Inuvik. So we came on, we started off running because we were told we were going to be launching our broadcasting in a matter of weeks, and we had nothing. We had no content. We, like I said, we took off running. So we just completely searched immediately everywhere for content. As you know, it's a small industry, maybe in Canada, but particularly in Nunavut or in, on Inuit lands. There's only a handful of people that do specialize in this and that are very good at it. 2 years ago in February, in May, Tom and I ended up getting our first employee, amazing, amazing woman as well, Linda O'Shaughnessy, who is originally from Baker Lake, and she has like 30 years of experience in broadcasting, and she just completely relieved us when she came on board. So we launched in June.
Of last summer.
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's been absolutely amazing. We started off as a five-hour broadcasting programming, and we do need to meet 80% of it in Inuktitut. We do try to cover the circumpolar world and all of Inuit Nunavut in Canada. And we do broadcasts all across the country. We are on Shaw Direct, Bell Satellite, Arctic Cooperatives Limited, TELUS. We are all across. What's more amazing is that and we thank the people that do provide us amazing content that we get right now. We just recently, in the last few weeks, switched over from 5 hours to now until nine in the morning till midnight, which is 15 hours.
Congratulations.
Yes, that was huge, huge, huge. Oh, it's just wonderful to be able to listen to your own language throughout the whole day, look at your own culture, and know that it's us that are doing it for Inuit. That has been a dream for such a long time, and we're telling our own stories, we're showing the world, hey, this is us, this is who we are. And it brings a lot of joy to be able to see this as an Inuk, for my children to be able to watch their own culture, because in Iqaluit, our children have grown up a little bit more different than we did as we lived in smaller communities. So it's been absolutely wonderful to be able to, I'm getting teary-eyed, Chum.
I understand.
This is how much, how important it is and how far Inuit have gone to be able to get to this point. As I mentioned, like it's perseverance, it's abilities, and for us to be able to, who you and I speak Inuit, but we don't hear our old traditional words that are not used so much anymore. So to be able to listen to those and to listen to other Inuit, how they speak all across Inuit Nunangat has quite a feeling of unity. Mm-hmm. We are one. We may be separated by borders that we, but we're not. We're collectively Inuit with different experiences, shared experiences, just time differences as mm-hmm. well. It's wonderful to see that mm-hmm. On Inuit TV.
Inuratike, we're going to take a little musical break before I carry on with my interview with my chum, Lucy Kavavauk. She is the co-CEO of Inuit TV. Here's an incredible Inuk artist originally from Saluit, Nunavik. She is Elisapi. Right now, she's rocking stages all over the world this summer. Her fifth album titled Inuktitut. In this one, she translates some of her favorite songs of her childhood into our language. I'm Madeline Alakirelek, and you are listening to Word and Culture. This is Elisapi singing Inu Niaravit, or Born to be Alive. That was Elisapi, her Polaris Prize long-listed album titled Inuktitut. I love when she's explaining why she wanted to do this album. She wanted the elders, Inuit elders, to understand the lyrics of all of our favorite songs of our youth. There's still a lot of work to be done. Now we have lyrics in Inuktitut we want our youth to understand as well. My guest in today's episode is Lucy Kavavauk. She's the co-CEO of Inuit TV, and I call her my chum. I asked her if she feels it's too late to save our language, because though she and I are bilingual Inuktitut speakers, with Inuktitut being our first language, our children understand, but they don't speak it.
As long as we talk about our language and our culture, I don't think it's ever too late. You and I do have children that partially do understand Inuktitut, but that don't completely fluently speak. Mm-hmm. That's where we need a lot more support. We are losing 2% of it every year, which is scary. In just a matter of 5 years, it'll be 10% and so forth. I believe we just need a lot more support, a lot more people to be able to carry these on. So for Inuit TV, that's one of the biggest things, for us to be able to hear our language throughout the whole day, at least 80% of the year of it anyway, to be able to constantly hear that, normalize it. We do have children's language programs, and that's one of the biggest things that we're trying to focus on in terms of our programming, to cover all across Inuit Nunavut, or in the Canadian regions anyway. One big thing that we worked on last year as a team with our president and with a regulatory lawyer, we went down to Ottawa for a two-day hearing. The Canadian Radio, Television, Telecommunications Commission, CRTC, we're trying to get a five-year license, and we're hoping to hear sometime soon, and it would be a five-year one where we would be able to get a total of 13 employees for Inuit TV. And that is, and from there, we're trying to move into a 18-hour programming, 18 hours a day in programming. And we're hoping to hear this summer, mm-hmm. or in the next few weeks, what the decision will be.
The future of Inuktitut and the look of our Inuit culture, with the knowledge and stories you've heard from the visionaries, where do you see yourself in this, as we move forward into the next years, growing older? Inuit have so much hope. Inuit have such vision. Inuit have maintained, like, they tried to eradicate us. They moved us to foreign land where our hunters didn't even know where the animals were. But what did they do? They survived, because that's what we need to do. And I think that's an important message for the next generation. I'm wondering where you see us moving forward into the next generation of Inuit.
What a fully loaded question, Chuck.
Yes, and our English teacher would have been like, that is not how you ask a question. That is not.
But that's how we do it.
Double barreled and everything.
For in terms of Inuit TV, like you said, there is a lot of hope. Yeah, Inuit are naturally completely talented, particularly in arts. And we see that in our seamstresses, we see that in our songs, we see that in our carvings, our storytellings. And one of the biggest things that Inuit have always naturally been natural at is storytelling. We were oral history. And now we are passing this on with new tools. So the younger generation, I can see the younger generation working for Inuit TV and just bringing in their own talent and their own ideas and their own visions, their our belief still being one, Inuktitut, and to be able to foster just building up and striving our culture. And I, with Inuit TV, I can see with the positions that we're trying to create, it's like, oh, I could see the younger generation making this even stronger. Mm-hmm. But with the foundation of our board, with the foundation of the idea, where it started, how it started, how many people it has taken to get to this point, there's just natural talent that I know with the youth that will be able to definitely keep this dream, keep this amazing, what came out of a little seed that just keeps flourishing, just to keep it alive, and our culture and our language.
Nakomik, thank you so much for sharing your stories. I know they're not easy. They're not lightweight whatsoever, but you're always up to a challenge. And